Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show, hour two of the show. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this hour, we'll take up a healthcare topic that we have done before on this program. From time to time, we have people who specialize in particular body parts, and we're happy to have back on the program once again for this hour, Dr. Robert Bourne. He is a podiatrist. He works at Carle in Urbana, and in his work, he's particularly concerned with the foot and the ankle, no higher than that. And he's been here a number of times in the past to answer questions. He will do his best. We always try to caution when we have doctors here on the show that there's some limitation that because the doctor can't see you. But if you want to call in, ask some specific questions. We do these shows to add to your health knowledge, and then you might want to take it from there with someone who can see you. But this is a place that you can start. Ask your question. I don't want to discourage anybody from calling. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for asking me again. Always great to be here.
We appreciate you giving us your time. Well, I do, in fact, have an email from someone here, so I will start off with this. Someone who identifies himself as a fan and a patient of yours and says that once you told him that he had fewer ligaments and tendons in his feet than the quote-unquote normal person, thus the cause of his foot problems. And he says you once joked that he had floppy feet syndrome. My first swimming teacher called out, "Who's the duck?" when he saw my footprints on the side of the pool. Is the lack of tendons and ligaments also the main cause of flat feet, or do some people that have flat feet also have the normal amount and type of connective tissue holding the foot together? He also sort of wonders, well, if indeed that's the case, is that something that's genetic some sort of developmental thing that might be just unique to him? So
I think in his case, what he's talking about is not necessarily the lack of ligaments or tendons in terms of number. It's their flexibility. So it's called ligamentous laxity, where the ligaments themselves have too much stretch to them. So unfortunately, this people always talk about being double-jointed, things of that nature, but that leads to basic instability in some of these joints, which is increases their range of motion past the norm, so it can actually cause some problems in terms of stability in the joint, wearing the joint out in cartilage early, and leading to some arthritic changes or just instability problems, flat feet, et cetera. Hmm. So that can be a problem. We see these patients, and sometimes they have it all over their body, obviously, and they'll have chronically dislocating shoulders. They'll dislocate their kneecap on other areas. So that's not necessarily a good thing. And there are some medical conditions that give you this particular problem. And just some people have ligaments that are looser than others.
Mm. All right. And is that something that tends to run in families?
It can, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I did actually was thinking that I would ask you about flat feet, since that's something, you know, people talk about, mm-hmm. having flat feet. And I remember, you know, there would have been a time when people would have talked about having been rejected from military service, you know, based on the fact that they had flat feet. And I was wondering about that and whether it is in fact true that there are some people who truly have no arch,
true.
On their feet. And so their feet really do go flat.
Lots of different types of flat foot, though. There's a true structural flat foot where if you see them sitting in a chair, their feet are just as flat as a pancake, where structurally they have no arch. Others who have a perfectly normal arch when they are off weight bearing, when they do bear weight, it totally flattens out and they don't have an arch at that point. So there's different causes for the flat foot and then different treatments associated with what particular type of flat foot someone has. Mm-hmm. And you always have to look for, especially in children, when they do have a flat foot, sometimes they'll have unilateral flat foot. You always look for abnormalities in regards to connections in some of the bones through the rear foot and the midfoot, which is called a tarsal coalition. And sometimes there's abnormalities in those areas, those bones that shouldn't be joined together are, and they lock the foot in that flat position. So sometimes that's a red flag to be sent up to, you need to go ahead and have that looked at, because those coalitions really have to be treated prior to them actually turning to bone, because those coalitions early usually are associated with cartilage. And as they do form to bone, then they cause more problems in the future.
So can that be a cause of foot pain? Having
oh, definitely. You know, and as far as in those patients, it's kind of hard to pick up sometimes because of the fact that, number one, the child doesn't know any different. And number two is that sometimes because there is some motion in that area because of the fact that it is not turned to bone and it's still cartilage, they can have some limitations and some discomfort but don't really come up till they get older. 10, 11, 12, 13 is when a lot of times they'll come in because of pain as that center is turning into bone and it's more uncomfortable for them. But it's nice to be able to catch it early so that you can do appropriate, usually surgical intervention to go ahead and fix it.
Yeah. That maybe leads to a question about arch support in shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly when I was a kid, all the gym shoes that we wore, the sole was just pretty much a flat piece of rubber.
Love those Converse.
That's right. Kind of like the Converse All-Star. And you can still buy them. And then, of course, now we have a lot of very high-tech shoes.
Right.
And each shoe is different, which you would know if you try it on different kinds of shoes. And,
mm-hmm.
and so you might, depending on the shape of your foot, you might put on a shoe that had an enormous arch in there and that you would feel like there was a hill underneath your foot.
Right.
And so there can be a great deal of difference. I guess the question is, how important is arch support? And, you know, how do you think about that when you're thinking about what you're going to wear on your feet?
I think a lot of it basically has to do with the normal mechanics and structure of the person's foot and if they have any symptoms associated with it. I'm not a firm believer of everybody needs arch support, and a lot of times it's nice to just have the foot function the way it's supposed to. The arch is there, and there's some flexibility to absorb shock, things of that nature, so it has to have the ability to flatten out. Flattening out or pronating of the foot is a normal activity. It's not something that you're supposed to go ahead and stop. So it's where we have excessive pronation or prolonged pronation through the gait cycle is when we run into the pathology associated with it. So if we have shoes, that's one of the reasons why the shoes normally have just a standard type of arch support. In pathologic conditions, it doesn't do a lot, but in just general conditions, it can be helpful. But some shoes are made with a real high arch, but a lot of times people can't tolerate them, so... And you kind of keep those in mind for some patients who might need that. But if I'm going to go ahead and treat somebody with an excessive pronation or a flat foot condition, it's always best to utilize a custom molded support because that tends to go ahead and control them to a greater extent. And so that it's hard to say because of the fact that so many feet are different. It's hard to go ahead and put a blanket comment on the arch supports.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist. You have questions about feet and foot health and foot care, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to talk with there in Mahomet. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Actually, I have arches on both sides of my feet, so they're really high, and I have had plantar fasciitis maybe associated with that. My question basically was whether you can tell me a little more about soaking your feet, because a number of people have suggested that that would be a good thing.
As far as foot soaks are concerned, I'm not a big foot soaking fan, but because I don't really feel as though it provides a lot of benefit in terms of structural abnormalities. The idea is that it increases the blood flow to those particular parts of your foot.
Mm-hmm.
If it makes it feel better, that's fine. But I don't necessarily know if it's really doing a lot to improve the particular problems. Especially in your case, it's true. A true cavus foot or a real high arch foot is something you look at from the outside. And that's when you see those patients who, when they stand, you can almost see daylight underneath their foot.
Yeah,
because of that fact. And those foot types are difficult to control because they're usually very tight. The plantar fascia is very tight and it's subject to tearing as a result of the tightness of it. And so those are situations where you really do like to go ahead and provide some support for the arch itself because it is not very flexible. So I think in cases of discomfort with plantar fasciitis in cavus feet, the soaking really doesn't do much good, but the support does.
Okay, yeah, I do have the support.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
All right, very good. Again, other questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, here's another question that's come in by email for someone who is interested if you can talk about the progression from an adult first having A1C values that are a bit above 7 to later having significant foot circulation problems that could potentially lead to amputation. So what they want to know, is this take a long time to happen? Does it only happen for people who have very high A1C values? And in fact, what would you consider to be a high A1C value?
Interesting, because I'm not an endocrinologist, and I don't treat diabetes in general. I see complications to diabetes and peripheral vascular disease. Mm-hmm. In terms of the direct correlation between A1C levels and peripheral vascular disease, I guess I'd have to defer to the vascular folks. But, you know, certainly we know that good control of the blood sugars anywhere with A1Cs below 7 is really kind of the magic number in trying to get that good control. It is funny, though. I see some patients who are very uncontrolled diabetics who have fine circulation. I see other ones that have good control that have lousy circulation. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into peripheral vascular disease in patients. So that's not a blanket statement that you can make either yeah. about that. But you know, certainly control of your blood sugars, diet, exercise, those are the great things about diabetes. It's always one of those situations people say, boy, it's a terrible disease to have, which I agree. But at least the patient themselves has some ability to influence the progression of their disease, which is really nice. If you told a cancer patient that, boy, if you follow your diet, take your medicine, and do some exercise, you do pretty well with this cancer. They would take that as a great opportunity. Yeah. So diabetics do have that advantage where they can go ahead and influence their disease. So that would be the thing to do.
Okay. Well, hope that helps. Again, other questions, you want to give us a call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We're for a while now, I'm sure, because we've had some warmer temperatures, people have hauled out their sandals.
Yes.
And one of the things that we're told is that there are a lot of people, probably not very many guys, mostly women, who are real unhappy with the way their feet look.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, I guess I'm not exactly sure how you make a foot look pretty. I got socks on. Are there any particular things that you would say? Is this just really all about, you know, cosmetics and that there is nothing really special that you could do just to improve the appearance of your feet?
I guess that's true. That's another thing that people always ask me. You know, they say, boy, aren't these the worst looking feet you've ever seen? I usually say, no, that's not. They're not even
as a guy who's seen a lot.
Yeah, they're not even the top 10. But also, I don't never look at the foot as far as the aesthetics of it. It's either, it's function. So
either it works or it doesn't.
Yeah, and so I do get a lot of women come in and complain about, roughness of the skin, callousing, toenails that don't particularly look normal. What can I do about this? And unfortunately, just normal skin care. That's one of the things we talked about as far as soaking is concerned. Soaking actually dries the skin out. So we try to go ahead and say that's not a good idea. Use of certain types of sandals will go ahead and give callousing around the backs of the heels. So utilization of just good skin care, keeping your feet clean and dry, utilizing emollients if you do have dry skin. Some people who neglect them have the best looking skin. So it varies with a lot of times the footwear that's used. And as far as the sandals are concerned, just keep them clean, dry, and moisturized.
Yeah, okay. And moisturizing for the feet is something you might want to think about too.
Yeah, I mean, if there are situations where there's some dryness of those areas, but you got to be kind of careful. Sometimes people do have some excessive dryness or cracking of the skin because they have too much perspiration or sweating in the feet, or they get too wet. Mm-hmm. So those are those difficult cases where you try to tell somebody, I need to keep your feet dry, but I need to keep them moisturized at the same time. So change in socks, change in shoes, let the shoe dry out, never wear it 24 hours straight, rotate your shoes. And those people who have a significant perspiration problems, and those where I tell them to use antiperspirants on their feet because the same antiperspirant that will work elsewhere in the body, under the arms, etc., will also go ahead and help control sweat glands in the bottom of the foot as well. So they can help with that. And that does significantly help sometimes with those situations where the skin is dry and cracked because of actually too much moisture.
Does the material that you're, if you're wearing socks, does the material that they're made out of make much difference?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, some of the obviously, if you have ones that have more polyester, nylon, et cetera, they tend to hold the moisture in versus allowing it to evaporate. Cotton blends are good to use. The smart wools are great to use. You know, of course, in the summertime, people don't like to use them because they're a little warm. But, you know, it's just any materials that will wick the moisture away from the skin and put it into the sock and the shoe is the best thing.
Yeah, I have somebody who is close to me who is a great fan of the smart wool socks and has pointed out. It has pointed out the fact that they do come in different weights and that you might not think about wool socks summertime, but the lightest weight, I am told, work just fine in the summertime.
Yeah, I'm wearing a pair now. They're the Dress Smart Wool, and they're reasonably thin, but they're a great comfortable sock, and it does a good job in terms of wicking moisture away.
Yeah, well, some of the calls here. Let's go back to the phones. Somebody in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, I wanted to fact check something with you that I read on the internet and ask a couple questions. Pain on the top of the foot. What I've read is that to prevent or help that, I should get a full foot orthotic. So first of all, do you think that's true? And second of all, are they talking about something I could buy at the store or at a shoe store, or are they talking about something that would have to be custom made for my foot?
Usually, full foot orthotic is, you know, a lot of times we call them full contact orthotics. There could be a problem with exactly what you're referring to, but the regular full orthotics would be just full length in terms of all the way to the toes. The full contact insert would be one where it is custom molded so that the contact with the bottom of the foot is filled in with the support. So it offers maximum support and control for the bottom of the foot. Now, the problem with pain on the top of the foot, that can be lots of different things that are causing the pain on the top of the foot. So that's hard to say if that would be effective, because it's hard to say what's causing the pain on the top of the foot. Pain on the top of the foot can be anything from rubbing from the shoe, impingement of some of the superficial nerves, inflammation of the tendons, arthritic changes in some of the joints, lots of different stuff that, because the top of the foot has no padding on it, just like the extensor surface of the hand and wrist, it's subject to a lot of trauma. So lots of different things can cause problems there.
Okay. Well, I think what this was talking about was that it was being caused by the arch flexing, and that causes the bones to move throughout the foot, and that causes pain. But you're saying it's not that simple,
well,
maybe.
Yeah, well, that could be an explanation. As the foot collapses and the arch collapses, you jam the joints on the top of the foot and open up the ones on the bottom. So you can have ligamentous strain on the bottom and joint jamming and discomfort on the top. So that if that was the case, that would be helpful. But it's really something that you need to probably have somebody assess to make sure that you're doing the right thing for it.
So don't diagnose over the internet.
That's always difficult.
Okay. Thank you very much,
okay.
Doctor.
All right. Thank you. On again to a caller in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Take ankle inversion sprain seriously. I'm regretting walking it off, as it were, from years ago. It's a very complicated thing, the foot, and my case is too, but I didn't know there was a sinus in the foot. I have the latest diagnosis. Other than, you know, debriding the Bassett's ligament ankle pain from the inversion, there's also the idea that I have, well, the latest doctor treating is tarsal sinus syndrome, which I see goes back to the 50s, but apparently is overlooked sometimes. So fibrous development in this fatty sort of shock-absorbing thing between the two long, is that a good characterization? And
true,
can you tell
true.
can you tell me about it? I've had this pro-inflammationary treatments in the past, both the ESWT for the plantar fasciitis, I don't know if that's still in favor, and then PRP injections. For,
right.
But the current idea is that it's actually the fibrous buildup, which doesn't respond to the pro-inflammationary treatment. So what do you think? Or well, can you just elaborate on some of those complexities, I guess? I don't know.
Right. You know, that's it is a difficult problem, and sometimes it's then surgical in nature in terms of going in there and cleaning stuff up. The other is, like as you said, which was one of the big things, is under treatment of inversion ankle sprains. Frequently, that's something that we see a lot of in terms of not adequately rehabbing the ankle ligaments properly, and then again that causes some instability in the joints of the ankle and the subtalar joint. So I think in general that's one of those things that is underserved frequently, and that's something that really does need to be addressed in a lot of cases. And that's just to make sure that people don't tend to go ahead and walk off ankle sprains, because then they can lead to further problems down the road.
Subtalar joint, is that related to the tarsal area, or where are we talking
right,
about?
Right, that sinus tarsi basically is the a portion of the subtalar joint. The joint is, and that's the joint below the ankle joint directly.
Okay, what do you think about these? Off of my own subject, what do you think about these pro-inflammation treatments that are where it's not out yet?
Well, I mean that's. Those treatments have been around for a long time, and that's kind of the idea of trying to take a chronic inflammatory condition or situation and turn it into an acute one, because the body will tend to go ahead and try and heal an area for a period of time, and then it just says, okay, it stops. And that's the whole idea behind all those things that you were talking about, is to try to take that chronic inflammatory situation, turn it into an acute one, so then the body can go ahead and marshal forces to go ahead and heal those areas. So it's been around for a long time. It just is a matter of being able to control how much acute inflammation that you get in those particular areas and see if it works. So
has platelet-rich plasma has been around for a while? I thought that was pretty...
Right. I mean, some, as I said, but all the kind of the different areas... The platelet-rich plasma, no, that's something that is relatively new over the past 3 or 4 years, or maybe even a little bit longer than that. But again, some of the other ones, as far as the extracorporeal shockwave therapy, prolotherapy, all those particular areas are kind of, they try to do the same thing.
Yeah. If I might have another moment, I just was asked whether I was getting prolotherapy, and I had never heard of it. And this injecting again something that's going to antagonize,
right? To cause an inflammatory response, and so an acute inflammatory response to go ahead and try to help stimulate the body to heal itself, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, the platelet-rich plasma is also platelet and white blood cell rich, apparently. So,
right,
it's actually, they may not know all the modalities of how it may or may not be working in different locations. But
true.
Okay, well. Thanks a lot.
All right. We'll go on again and talk with somebody in Champaign. Line number 3 right here. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask if the doctor had ever heard of a treatment for toenail fungus using fixed vapor rub, or whether that's an old wives' tale. A relative told me about it. So if you can tell me if you've ever heard of that.
I've heard of it for a long time. I've used it in myself for about the last 30 years. The Vicks VapoRub, I don't think, goes ahead and cures anything. But the idea is the eucalyptus oil in the Vicks is what gives Vicks its actual it's the smell of the Vicks. Has some antifungal properties to it. So that's the one idea. And the other is that the other base, which is a petrolatum base, which is like Vaseline, has a tendency to go ahead and decrease the hardness of the material underneath and around the nail, underneath the nail itself, the skin on the sides of the nail. So it certainly makes it feel more comfortable, and then it's easier to manage the thickness of the nail and the debris underneath the nail. Again, whether it actually cures the fungus or not, I really, I don't, I don't think it does. Very difficult to get rid of toenail fungus, unfortunately.
Yes. Is it the kind of thing where you pretty much would have to use it all the time? And if so, when's the best time to apply it and, you know, that sort of thing?
I would say yes, you have to use it all the time, and the best time to apply it is, let's say, after bathing. Again, it's one of those situations where if you have a – you want to keep it in contact with the skin and the nail as much as possible. So it wouldn't make much sense to put it on before you go to bed and then wash it off in the morning. So
Okay. That
would be the best thing to do.
But you could put it on and then put something over it, like a sock.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and a little bit goes a long way. You don't put so much on there that, you know, you're sliding around in your shoes.
Right, but that would be, the one today would be fine.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Robert Bourne from Carl in Urbana. He's a podiatrist, so we're talking about the foot and the ankle. You have questions, you can give us a call. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, pianist Jeremy Denk talks about his new album of Ligeti piano etudes and Beethoven sonatas. You've got to be pretty obsessive to tackle some of these, and apparently he is. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening in. We are on the program here Monday through Friday at 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Let me mention, too, for tomorrow, in the first hour, we'll be talking with Homer Hickam. He's a writer, a former aerospace engineer with NASA. A lot of people will know his memoir, Rocket Boys, which was made into a movie, October Sky. He's written many novels. He has a new one out, which is for young adult readers. The title of the book is Crater, and it's set on the moon. So it's science fiction, set 120 years in the future with people living on the moon. We'll talk a little bit about that, about his life, about his writing tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour. Then in hour number two tomorrow, the 11 o'clock hour, the guest is Enrico Moretti. He's an economist from UC Berkeley, and we'll be talking about his new book, The New Geography of Jobs, where he makes this argument that in the future, your success, it might not just be about who you are, but also about where it is you happen to live, particularly if you live near certain high-tech hubs like places like San Francisco or Boston or Austin or Durham. More on that tomorrow. You can check the schedule by going to the website. It's will.illinois.edu. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. You can also check us out on Facebook. In this hour of the show, the guest is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist, and we're talking about feet and foot care. And if you have foot questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sure that many times over the years we've had these conversations, we've talked about the problem of the toenail fungus and how hard that is to treat. And I came across something, and apparently at some point there was a thought that actually lasers might be used to tackle the problem, although with the thrust of this recent article that I saw was that maybe it was in the New York Times, that, well, yeah, I guess at one point they thought that might help, but now they're not so sure. Where are we with the possibility of using lasers as a treatment for toenail fungus?
That's one of the problems with medicine, you know, is that everyone comes up with these new ideas, and unfortunately, there's not a lot of science behind some of them. And the laser business has been something that's been around for a long time. I remember when I first kind of heard about this, boy, that's got to be 6 or 7, 8 years ago, where there was a clinical trial that I was trying to become involved with utilizing laser in terms of treating the toenail fungus, and the design of the experiment was really good, and you took a look at that particular group and that company that was trying to do this. Boy, they had a lot of articles and works published, and so that going through exactly different testing, can I kill the fungus in a petri dish with a laser? Can I, and what's the most effective way to do that? So as soon as you find that out, what wavelength did you need of the laser, et cetera? Now they found out that a dual wavelength that you needed two. So now how far does the light source have to be from the subject so that you don't, you can kill the fungus, but you don't also pulverize the toe at the same time? So it gets to be interesting to go ahead and do. But the problem is that then you get a lot of other companies that say, yes, this is something that can be done and it will work, but they don't have any good hard science behind it. So I've been in practice long enough to say, okay, I will take a look and keep an eye on these things, but will they be there in 5 years? If they really work, they will be there in 5 years, and in fact, that will become the standard of care. So we see all these type of things, and it was a hot topic, say, 5 years ago, and now it's kind of waning because we find that, no, it really doesn't work. So that's the problem. It's really hard to go ahead and kill fungus because obviously it's a nail bed infection versus nail plate most of the time. So the nail plate itself provides protection, you know, for lasers. You know, you got to penetrate the nail plate to get to the nail bed, but not kill the nail bed at the same time. So it's difficult.
So it's for the present, then, really all you got is the oral antifungal medication.
We still do, but again, my take on fungal infections is it's an immune system deficiency in those patients, because frequently you'll ask them, is this something that it runs in your family? Oh yeah, everybody's got it in my family. Have you had any experience with the oral antifungals in the past? Oh yeah, I've taken them before, and I've cured this many times. So, and then it just comes back. So the reoccurrence rate is very high in these cases, because if you think about it, they may not have any natural immunity against the fungus. The fungus itself is something that you really can't stay away from. So it just tends to reoccur.
Well, we have some other callers here. We have plenty of time to take additional calls. If you have questions about foot issues, you can give us a call. Talk with our guest, podiatrist Dr. Robert Bourne, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, and that's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've had so many foot problems, you'd think, you know, it's just one thing after another. I won't go into all of that. I wanted to ask you specifically about bunions, what they are, and can you get rid of them?
Bunion specifically, when most people talk about bunions, they mean the protrusion on the medial or inside of their foot behind their big toe. You can have a bunion on the outside of your foot, too, but it's called a bunionette, where it's
right.
Involved with the fifth toe.
Yeah.
The bunions themselves, it's a migration of that first metatarsal bone. People think that it's a calcium deposit behind the big toe joint, and no, it's not. It's actually a movement of that first metatarsal bone one way and the toe the other way. And then it can then influence the rest of the foot because of the fact that now we've lost the normal ability for the metatarsal bones to equally distribute the weight throughout the entire foot. So then you can load the area behind the second toe. And frequently I've had patients come in complaining about pain in the ball of their foot behind their second toe as their symptom. And the bunion really doesn't cause them a lot of problem. But unfortunately, the bunion is the reason for the pain in the second, the ball of the foot behind the second toe. So frequently you have to go ahead and consider trying to reestablish normal weight bearing conservatively, utilizing a support, accommodative shoe, an orthotic. If that doesn't work, then surgically going ahead and realigning the whole medial column of the foot to go ahead and put everything back into its proper position. So that can be done. And bunion surgery is successful. I've retired from doing surgeries for the last 7 or 8 years, but the bunion surgery that we did beforehand was very successful. As long as you choose the right procedure in the right patient and the post-operative course goes well, it's very rewarding. I've seen patients, I did their surgery 25, 26 years ago, and they're straight as an arrow. So they do tend to go ahead and maintain their correction, and they do very well.
You say that the bunion is a result of a migration of the metatarsal.
Right.
How does the metatarsal get to the point where it's migrating?
Well, because of the let's say, biomechanical instability of the foot, the flattening out of the foot, excessive pronation, we get a situation where we lose stability in that inside or medial column of the foot. And the muscles, ligaments, et cetera, that are normally there to work in with equal and opposite force to stabilize those areas, they don't anymore. And so there's
right.
mechanical advantage in this. So they start to pull and deviate these bones and joints, and that's the deformity that's set up.
Okay. And so are there specific orthotics? Now it seems that even from the physicians, you receive these things that look like over-the-counter orthotics mm-hmm. for flat feet. Is there an orthotic that can kind of assist the metatarsal in not leaning over and pronating so much?
To a point. If you have a foot that does not have a bunion, and you notice that you find the medial column instability, you can try to go ahead and utilize the orthotic to prevent the bunion formation. But just like eyeglasses, they're not going to go ahead and wear them for 6 months and you can see well and you don't need them anymore and your eyes are healed. The orthotic cannot take a bunion and go ahead and improve it. So once it's formed, it will not go ahead and decrease the deformity. Hopefully it may prevent it from getting worse, but also there is that point when you do have enough instability, I don't care what you do, the bunion still can go ahead and get worse.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do appreciate your information. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll go next to someone on a cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I have a question for the doctor.
Sure.
It may fall outside of the School of Medicine, but it does involve the foot. I, about a week ago, had an ACL repair and meniscal repair. About 12 hours after the procedure, I began to develop numbness and tingling in the bottom of my foot, from the ball of the foot back to the back of the ankle. I've also got some bruising on the medial side of the foot, and it has not really resolved. There is some swelling in the ankle and in the calf. The physician thinks it may have been a result of some swelling on the saphenous nerve, and I've been keeping it elevated and iced, but there's really no resolution of the numbness, and I'm beginning to get a little concerned about it. I was interested in the podiatrist's thoughts on that.
Obviously, any time that you have numbness, there's been a nerve insult somewhere. The funny thing about nerves is it's just like an electrical system in the house. It's the trying to find out where that is. And that's something that takes a little detective work. So that's something that, you know, it all has to do with the distribution of the numbness. Because we know everything in the body is mapped out, just like, again, like your electrical system in the house. You have, you know, power comes in, you've got a breaker box, and all those little breakers go to all the different places, kitchen, air conditioner, etc. So in the case of the human body, there's dermatomes, which we know which areas that the nerve runs. So if somebody says, I have numbness, big toe, second toe, top of the foot, bottom, in this distribution, that gives the person an idea of where that what nerve is involved and where and what to look for. So in cases of that, either neurologists would have to go ahead and run some tests to see exactly what nerves are involved, to see if there was damage higher up. Is this something that is even higher than where the site of the surgery was? You have an impingement, sciatic nerve impingement. I mean, it could be a lot of different things. The fact that you have bruising down in the area of the inside of the foot, ankle, et cetera, that's pretty common. When you have bleeding, the blood will go ahead and migrate usually as gravity pulls it down, so that's not uncommon to see. But the numbness certainly would be a concern, and just trying to figure out where that is, as I said, take some detective work, and usually that we call it the neurologist, the electricians of the body, so it'd be something to go ahead and, you know, they have to go ahead and look at it to see what nerves may be involved to figure out exactly what the problem may be.
Well, is there any consequence or further aggravation with just giving it the medicine of time for a period without further intervention by a neurologist, either through EMG or some other study to determine where the nerve is irritated?
Well, certainly that's the case, you know, and a lot of times if there is a nerve involvement or an injury, they do take a long time to get better. So as long as you don't see worsening of the symptoms, and then maybe some improvement in the symptoms, then, yeah, you can go ahead and certainly give it some time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Well, and again, we'll go to another caller. Ridge Farm is the next person. Line number three. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I appreciate your show.
Sure.
I hope this question is not redundant. I missed out on about the first 15 minutes of the show, but could you do a little explanation on heel spurs, what causes them, and how to alleviate the pain, or just have to cope with it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
Heel spurs are an interesting topic. Unfortunately, I don't even like to use the word and term heel spurs because I really don't think they exist. It's an old term and an idea that there is a spurring of the bone on the bottom of the heel bone itself that causes pain because people step on this spike of bone and that causes the problem. And when in reality, it's not. What you see on an X-ray is really calcification of the soft tissue that attaches to the bone, and it's a little bit of a difference, but I think it's an important difference because we see it on the back of the heel where the Achilles tendon attaches, and we see it on the bottom of the heel where the plantar fascia and some of the musculature attaches, and it's really just an indication that there's chronic inflammation in those tissues, and these are called enthesopic changes, meaning that's an enthesis is the term for soft tissue attachment to bone. And so that's really what we see. It's interesting nowadays, we even get when the radiologist will go ahead and read X-rays. In the past, they used to say, oh, heel spur here and there. Now they say enthesopic changes noted in soft tissue attaching to the bone, which is great to see because that's really what it is. So when you explain to patients that that's the case, it's a little easier then for them to understand the fact that you're trying to treat the problems of why that's inflamed in the first place. And it's usually, again, the attachment of these things because of the different forces that are at work putting stress on those spots. So that's where we go ahead and usually utilize orthotic control, making sure that the patient goes ahead and doesn't do any barefoot walking or standing, which I find is one of the big keys, so that you give the body an opportunity to try to heal these areas. The feet are the really bad things to work on because we have injured spots, we have damage to tissue, and how do we treat it? We just go ahead and continue to walk on it. And so how's it ever going to get better unless we go ahead and rest it? Well, unfortunately, it's great to rest a shoulder, but it's impossible to rest a foot. So we have to go through these extraordinary measures of utilizing supports, no barefoot walking or standing, et cetera, so that we can give the foot a little bit of a chance to rest and heal. And that's also why it doesn't respond quickly. It takes months for it to go ahead and get better versus weeks. So those are the problems with, and as I said, I don't even take X-rays in feet to make sure that people don't get this idea that they have these heel spurs when really they look like a spike of bone, but in reality they're a shelf that goes along the entire course of the bottom of the foot. So they aren't what they appear.
Okay. I don't know if the caller is still there. Did you want to follow up?
Dietary have anything to do with it?
No.
No?
No, except with in terms of dietary is obesity. That's one of the biggest things. You load the foot to a great extent, and it can only take so much. So
sure.
Obviously, if you have less weight than it does, that certainly is helpful.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Over again to somebody in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah. Does radiation, prostate radiation, have an influence on your feet? Does it hit the nerves and other parts of your body so that you walk like a duck?
I don't know. That's a good question. I've never been asked that question. But if again, as it kind of brings us back to what we're another caller had saying about symptoms. If somebody has had prostate radiation and then they come up with lower extremity symptoms of, well, we talk about paresthesias. Paresthesias being numbness, tingling, pain, any of those particular type of things in their feet, then that's a possibility that there was some damage to the nerves locally in that particular area.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions, again, are welcome. We have about 5 minutes left in the show with Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist from Carl in Urbana. We are starting to hear more and more about the consequences of people being over their healthy body weight. And diabetes is certainly one of them, and it increases your risk of heart disease and stroke, and it puts a greater burden on your joints. Mm-hmm. So that might be an issue. There's all kinds of things. Are you, in fact, starting to see, or do you think we're starting to see foot and ankle problems that are related to people being too heavy?
I don't think we're starting.
It's been for a while? Oh, okay.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things that it's very true. You know, these poor little feet, I mean, they're designed to just take a certain amount of load, and we're really, really going ahead and stressing it. But the thing that always gets me is that is the the fact that I have patients come in all the time saying, boy, yeah, I know I'm overweight, so I've increased my exercise to a great extent, and I can't because now my feet hurt real bad. Well, yeah, that's not a surprise. And the problem is that I know exercise is important for weight loss, but I think it's sometimes it's overemphasized because, you know, we really need to go ahead and decrease the caloric intake, and we need to lose the weight before we do the exercise sometimes. Or if you're going to do the exercise, you need to have non-gravity exercise. So you're going to have to try to really limit the stress that you put on your lower extremity. People come in, you know, terrible knee pain, I have to stop exercising, and that makes me depressed, and I have to eat. So you have to go ahead and be able to design an exercise program if you are going to try to lose weight, especially if you have a situation where some of these other musculoskeletal issues are there, that water aerobics is great, you know, biking, these other things that you can go ahead and try to do without overstressing these other structures, because then it's going to set you up to failure. And a lot of times patient comes in and says, you know, again, I can't lose any weight because you can't get my feet to stop hurting. Mm-hmm. So you really have to go ahead and concentrate on the weight loss first, and then go ahead and utilize the exercise. If you can go ahead and walk, it's great. And if you can go ahead and try to take it easy and do it gradually to go ahead and help with the weight loss, that's fine. But the weight loss still has to be kind of first and foremost.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the foot glove. As people make this argument, people have made this argument, well, human beings were born to run, mm-hmm. but they weren't born to wear shoes.
I agree.
And that somehow it would be more natural for people to run barefoot. But that's kind of a problem because of the surfaces that we have to run on. So you don't want to damage the foot. So someone has invented, and there are a number of versions of this, these things that you wear on your feet.
Yeah, the minimalist shoes,
yeah,
yes.
That they have, they look kind of like gloves because mm-hmm. they have little pockets for your toes to go in. And I occasionally see people wearing them, just wearing them around, and I'm thinking, mm-hmm. is that really such a good thing?
I don't really have any complaints. As long as, you know, again, I agree with them because it's true. The foot wasn't designed to be in a shoe. It was never designed for that. And, mm-hmm. of course, unfortunately, it was never designed to go ahead and walk on hard, level engineered surfaces either. And that's where we run into troubles. Because, and unfortunately, also, if you take a look at feet, they're as diverse as people are diverse. So they're not the same. So it's hard when you go ahead and have a shoe to make a shoe for everybody's foot because everybody's foot is different. So these particular type of minimalist shoes, I don't have any complaints as long as people can wear them and they don't have any symptoms. So, but it would be best to always, you know, run on softer surfaces and things like that.
Yeah. Is it bad, you think, for people to go barefoot?
It. I don't think it's bad to go barefoot, but it's only bad to go barefoot when it exacerbates some pathology. So, I think especially for kids, I'm a firm believer in they don't need shoes. Mm-hmm. You know, they need to have the freedom of movement of their feet so they can develop the musculature and everything else properly, especially in infants, et cetera. They need something, the covering of their foot, to go ahead and protect them, but they don't need any structured shoes. So it's like putting a kid in a ski boot, you know, and saying, or an adult in a ski boot and say, go ahead and walk around. Some of these children's shoes, my God, they're so stiff. And of course, mom yeah. comes in, why is my child so clumsy? You take their shoes off and they run around and they're perfectly fine. So I believe in that as well. But as far as barefoot, I mean, again, it's fine as long as you don't have those other problems.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit earlier about people we're now into the sandal mm-hmm. wearing season, and I'm thinking about there's a particular brand of shoe that's become extremely popular that has a very distinct design, and one of the features is it's got this great big toe cap, and I'm talking about Keens.
Oh, okay.
And I guess I'm just thinking about the fact that they, as far as I know, that I can remember, they were the first ones that started to market a sandal that covered your toes, mm-hmm. which seem actually to me to be, well, actually, that sounds like a pretty good idea, right? Because it protects your, you know, toes from right. getting smashed. And mm-hmm. I wonder about that. Whether, do you see people who get toe injuries and
oh,
get their
God,
toes
yes.
hurt because because of sandal wearing?
Yeah, my favorite is the screen door. It's
I don't even like the sound of it.
Avulsing the toenails based on the screen door. But yeah, we see a lot of that kind of stuff. But yeah, the Keens are great. They're a well-designed footwear, and they work out very well.
Yeah. Anything else in general you might say to people when you're mm-hmm. going out to buy shoes, you might want to think about?
I think the fit is the most important thing. And so that it's still best to go somewhere they can go ahead and look at your foot, and they can assess the size, shape of your foot, and to go ahead and match a shoe that matches your foot. Because, again, there's so many people that have so many different appearances to their foot. People don't realize that if I have somebody who has got really long toes and really short toes, they can have the exact same length of foot and exact same width of their foot, but they're not the exact same feet. So the problem is they're going to bend in different spots, and so you have to make sure that they have a shoe that will go ahead and accommodate where their foot bends and again the shape of their foot in general. Mm-hmm. So the best shoe for someone is the one that fits their foot the best.
And for those people who would come along and say something like, well, you know, I'm a size 9. I've always been a size 9. Don't bother measuring my foot.
No.
Give me a size 9.
No.
No.
No. Because, unfortunately, I got that complaint. You know, someone who's 85 years old comes in and says, well, I've worn the same size shoe for, you know, how, you know, you're crazy. I said, well, I'm going to call the National Enquirer and say, well, I got great news, great world-shaking news. Everything in the body changes except the foot. It stays the same all your entire life. Well, that's not true. It will certainly change in terms of getting wider and longer as we get older because of the fact the ligaments tend to stretch. And so as a result of that, we go ahead and have change in size of the foot. So frequently, I know if someone's been in the same size shoe for 40 years, it doesn't fit their foot.
Yeah. All right. So you would say go if you can, go to some place where they're going to measure it for you.
It's nice if you can find somebody who doesn't pick up your shoe and look inside and says, oh, you need this particular size. You know, measure twice, cut once, and that's really important as far as shoes are concerned, too.
Okay. Well, there we'll leave it with our thanks to Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist from Carl over in Urbana. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.